Hi there, and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years, and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them, and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds, and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado to today's episode. We've seen many examples of situations where adversity can bring people back to their true entrepreneurial selves, giving them the spark to start a business they may well have always been destined to do, even if they didn't know it at the time. I think today's guest might fall into that category. For nearly 30 years, Pamex has blazed a trail in the Irish pharmaceutical industry. Its founder, Tom Murphy, was a leading figure in the pharma industry in the 1980s and early 1990s, before being made redundant in 1994. Still in his mid-40s and with a young family, he found himself on the dole at a time when unemployment in Ireland was at a record high. Using his industry knowledge and backed all the way by his wife Mary, the couple started the business that has built up a diverse portfolio of products that have made an immeasurable difference to the health and well-being of countless Irish people. Its first brand was Total Shaving Solution, has been joined by names such as Carmex Lip Balm, Alflorex Biotics, Kin Dental, Thea Eye Care, and many more, with the result that this company from Castlebar continues to punch way above its weight. Tom, you're very welcome to the podcast, and I hope I got it all in there.
Thank you very much, Aidan. It's amazing when you hear it read out like that.
Well, good. It's all true. That's the good news, folks. Let's start with an obvious one, in that you were laid off from a very, very successful career. You had no choice but to do something, and it had been, you had been kind of entrepreneurial. So was it as easy as that in terms of, the decision to start up Pamex, or was necessity the mother of invention in this case?
Well, it's very difficult to say which was which, actually, because when it happened, it was devastating. And my redundancy from Syntex Pharmaceuticals was finalised on Christmas Eve in 1994. So I remember that Christmas greatly, let's put it that way. But, and it was very, very strange. And I heard somebody say a few times that in a situation like that, you go through what is called the SARAH principle. Principle, S-A-R-A-H, which stands for shock, anger, resentment, acceptance and hope. And they said you have to go through that tunnel to get out the other side, to continue to be positive and to be hopeful for the future. And certainly I went through that, all those phases, so to speak. And I wondered what I would do. So the first step that I did was I decided I'd apply for a number of jobs that are available. And I sent out over 60 CVs and applications. And I got one acknowledgement, and I got one offer of a job from a company with which I had been doing business and to which I had not actually applied, which was fascinating in itself. But I decided to decline that offer. Nobody else replied to me. And I said, OK, well, maybe this is, let's turn it around and try and be as positive as we possibly could. And Mary and I decided, well, maybe this will be the opportunity to set up and do something on our own. And that's really how it happened.
Now, you'd had a history of entrepreneurial adventures prior to your pharmaceutical business.
Yes,
indeed. Your pharmaceutical career, I should say.
Yeah, very, very, very much so. From the time I was a young fella growing up in Castlebar, like I remember going down to the market square, as it was then, and on a Saturday selling potatoes and cabbage and carrots and all the vegetables from a farmer living out the road. And I'd jump up on his cart and go down and sell for him. And I was only about probably 7 years of age at the time. But what really got me was the joy on people's face when you gave them something that they wanted and they knew that what they were getting was of good quality and they were going to make good use of it. And it was amazing. And I remember one lady who lived in Market Square at the time, Mrs. McLaughlin, and I would bring over half a stone of potatoes to her house every Saturday morning after she bought it. She bought the potatoes. And she'd always give me a threepenny bit. And I said, well, this was good. And I, not only did I do well, but she did well too, because she was very happy. She gave me the threepenny bit, you know, which bought a good few cones in those days, yeah. Aidan. And, you know, it went from there. I was always interested in selling. I was always interested in the communication between a buyer and a seller, and how it can go wrong and how it can go right. Mm. And I think probably always in the back of my mind, I said, wouldn't it be great if we could? I was always looking for ideas and see what could we do? You know, would we think of doing this? I remember discussing it with a pal of mine. If we could get together and do a deal with the number of small dance bands at the time, could we book them into a hall and get a commission on it?
Yeah.
You know, and just different ways to make money, yeah. And to have fun at the same time. Mm. So this propelled me into a more serious way then of saying, look, I've had a good experience. I was 20 years in Syntex Pharmaceuticals, a wonderful, wonderful company in which to work. And they had taught me a great deal. And I said, look, I have a lot of knowledge. I have a good experience in the pharmaceutical industry at that stage, well over 20 years. And so I said, why not do something in that field? And what I did was I went to three business people in Castlebar who were not connected with the pharmaceutical industry at all. But I explained my situation. I went and I asked them, what do you think? Hmm. You know, individually. And each one of them said, well, if I were in your shoes, Tom, I would more or less stick to the knitting and go back to the pharmaceutical industry, or stay in that area or some area adjacent to it
yeah.
and make a living that way. Yeah. So that's exactly what I did.
And when did you consider yourself to be an entrepreneur or a business person, or do you still not consider yourself to be an entrepreneur?
Well, I don't know. I suppose people, that's for people to decide.
Yeah.
You know, they have always, you know, the entrepreneur term is more popular now than it was years ago. And in that context, I think it is up to people to give me that title or not. Mm. I never really considered much about it. I said, let's make a business. Let's do something that brings satisfaction and that improves people's lives. And if we can make a living out of that, aren't right. we contributing positively to the world? Mm. But not only that, we're making a living out of it, as I say, and it'll make us all happier.
Mm. You weren't too convinced about your first product, given its source, sure you weren't.
Which
the total shaving solutions, and I read in the book that, you know, it's very strange to get a shaving product from a barber who has a big beard.
Oh yeah, I certainly was not convinced of that one, and that barber still has a big beard, and probably the most famous beard in Castlebar, and that was Ger Staunton. Mm. And he's a great pal of mine. And I was having my hair cut one day, and Ger said, listen, I know that you have difficulty in shaving. Mm-hmm. You should try this product. And I looked at it, and it was in a small little bottle, about an inch high, or an inch and a half high. And I said, why, what does this do? And he said, well, he said, this is supposed to give you the cleanest, glossiest, smoothest shave ever. And there's no lather and no, what would I call it, no suds, mm-hmm. nothing like that. So I said, OK, I'll try it. But I said, I'm a sceptical guy. My name is Tom. So I presume in one sense it was from the biblical Doubting Thomas. But I know it's from the other side. It's from my father's name and my grandfather's name. Mm-hmm. And I said to Ger Staunton, I said, I'll give it a go. But I said, what the hell do you know about shaving? You haven't shaved in years. And he said, well, you're right about that. He said, but all that I can tell you, it's supposed to be quite good. And so I tried the product. And within about 10 days, that'd be about 10 shaves, I noticed that my skin, well, my wife first did, Mary did, she said, your skin has improved an awful lot. And I had great difficulty in shaving. Mm-hmm. It was an absolute nightmare. And I used shaving foam at the time, but I would cut myself from ear to ear. And I can tell you, there were some times when I'd have more toilet tissue on my face and neck than was left on the
like
roll.
Like the Barber of Seville, was it?
The Barber of Seville in every sense. But I can tell you, it was just a nightmare to shave. And in those days, most people wore white shirts. I was out on the road every day. I had a white shirt on me and, you know,
Not good.
And I had a big red rash around my neck, you know, the turkey neck, as I call it. And it wasn't good. So I tried this and it was bloody great. Mm. I couldn't get over it. So I decided, well, look, I never want to hold back. If I want to ask somebody a question, I will ask them a question. If they don't want to answer it, that is their prerogative. Mm. So I checked out where this little product came from. I rang up the company in Peoria, Illinois, and I asked to speak to the president. Now, I knew that all major companies in the States have a president. Right. Yeah. But I didn't realise how small this company was. There were three people working in it. One of them was the president. One of them was the president, anyway. So I rang them up. I spoke to the president and had a good chat with him about it. And he said, I asked him, could he send me on some free samples that I told him I was interested in it? And he sent me on, Bill Hamilton was his name. He sent me on some samples, but before he did, he said, how would you like to pay for it, Tom? And this was completely new to me because anywhere if you go for ask for samples, it was always regarded that they were free, right? So I had to pay him for them and I arranged that. I got about 100 or 200 tiny little bubbles that had sufficient oil in it for about 6 to 7 shaves. So I gave those bubbles out to friends and acquaintances around Castlebar, and the phone started ringing at home. Where can I get more of this stuff? This is absolutely amazing. Where did you get it? Are you going to sell it? All this kind of thing. So, excuse me, we decided that, you know, there might be a business in this after all. Mm-hmm. So what we did was I went out to Peoria, Illinois. This was all a great bit of fun, like, let's be quite honest with you, it was great crack. So we went out to Illinois, met Bill Hamilton, and had a chat with him and his right-hand woman there, Lynn, and I came away with the rights to the product for all the world except the United States. And he said to me there was one proviso. He said there was a company who had the rights to the product based in the UK, but he said they did very well for 6 months, but then they went and they made their own product. So his sales were going nowhere. So I said to him, if I sell more in 6 months than that guy sold in 2 years, can I have the full rights? And he said, you can. So we did that in about 3 months, right? So we did exceptionally well with it. It was a new product. It was a great product. And it was a product that wasn't a serious product. We could have a bit of fun with it. And we had one lucky opportunity, let's put it that way. I put an ad in the Sunday Tribune at the time. And I said, we have to make this that it's fun. And it was an ad for Desperate Dan. I don't know, was he from the Beano or the Dandy?
Was
it? And he used to have stubble. Yeah. So it was a black and white ad, you know, as if it was like a drawn in pencil. And it was a lovely ad. And it says, you try this product, and if you're not happy with it, we'll give you your money back, right? And we guaranteed you the best shave ever. And wasn't it picked up by Pat Kenny and his team on his morning radio show? And it worked wonders. And what happened with that was, they invited me to speak about it. And I said yes, and we arranged the time and everything. And some scandal broke just before I had gone into studio on the Monday morning, and they wanted to talk to a bishop in Boston, but I was in at 10 o'clock in the morning. That was whatever it was, 5 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the morning in Boston, and the bishop's house, there was nobody answering the phone. So he had extra time. So he went to a commercial break and he gave me extra time. And we talked about Syntex and talked about my life and sales. And then we went on about Total Shaving Solution. And the following week, we sold thousands of bottles. And thank you, Pat Kenny, for giving us that break.
You raise an interesting one there, because I do think an awful lot of people who, when it comes to entrepreneurs and things like that, they first consider themselves an entrepreneur and then go find a business. Whereas you're much more, and you say to yourself, you still not necessarily consider yourself an entrepreneur, but you saw a problem that needed to be solved or that could be solved, and you created a business out of it. And I think the latter are always more successful entrepreneurs, in my opinion, because they're fulfilling a need that they've identified.
And correct, yeah. And definitely, I was, you know, I'll be upfront, I was extremely selfish about it because I had an awful job shaving. It was horrendous. I hated it, absolutely hated it. And Total Shaving Solution, when I got it at the time, that product changed my life. Yeah.
switching, and as we say, as I said in the intro, Mary has been there all the way, right? But operating as a company or a family in a business, you know, where does the business end? Business end and the personal life start at home, or was there a very grey line between the two?
Well, I would say the latter. And I'll put it this way to you, you know, there's a lot of talk and a lot written about, you know, a work-life balance.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful in theory. There's no doubt about it. But I can say, in all honesty, you know, there was no work-life balance. It was all the one. And we roped in, if any of your listeners might care to look up Total Shaving Solution on YouTube, there's a clip on YouTube of us around the kitchen table.
Oh, looked at it.
Did you look at it? It's either on YouTube, actually, or it might be on Facebook or something like that, I don't know. But anyway, around the kitchen table where our kids are doing the packing, and my mother, God be good to her, is up at the top organising everything. And we're all there, and everybody roped in. So we took it in a light-hearted manner. I knew that what they were doing was very valuable. Our kids still throw it back in my face to a certain extent and say, yes, we wouldn't be allowed to do that nowadays.
Cheap labour.
Oh, no. They don't call it cheap labour, Aidan. They call it slave labour, you know, as it was at the time. But it was very much a family affair, and it's still very much a family company. And we still try to adhere to what I call the better sides of family values.
Switching tacks a bit, and I'm interested to get your thoughts on this one. You were from a reasonably big family, but you're the only brother not to go to university, and your mother was a teacher. So when you look back in it, you know, and you'd be in a good place to position this, is university just not for everyone? Do you regret it, I suppose, not going to university?
No, not a bit. Right. Not a bit. I was interested when I came up to leaving the service. Remember, there was a great pal of mine, and we'd meet on the way to school in the morning, and it was after our inter-cert, which I think is called a junior cert nowadays. And I said to him, "And how did you do?" And we discussed how we did and everything. And I said, "What are you going to do now?" I said, there was no such thing as transition year in that time. It was, "What are you going to do now when you finish?" "Oh," he said, "I hope to get a good pensionable job." Well, I nearly collapsed. Here we were at 16 years of age, and this guy saying he wanted a good pensionable job. And I will say, fair play to him, that's exactly what he did get, right? I said, "I've no interest in a pension." I said, "I've only two things I want to do after I do my leaving cert. Number one," I said, "is get a car. Number two is get a job."
And I need number two to do it.
And I need number two to get number one. And that was it. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to go out and I wanted to sell. I wanted to be a rep on the road. You know, a very good friend of mine, Pat Quigley. And Pat was a rep at the time he was at first Thompson's Cakes and then for Glaxo. He was a medical rep at Glaxo for many, many years. And a great guy. And I said, there's no reason why I can't be a medical rep. And my dad was working in the pharmacy, and my mother was a music teacher at that stage. So I said, "Look, I want to go and I want to become a medical rep." And I set my heart on becoming a medical rep by age of 25, and I made it by my 21st birthday. So I was happy with that.
And then you went to the University of Life.
And then I went to the University of Life, you know. Well, I had started that all the time because I think, you know, and I don't mind making mistakes, or I don't mind people making mistakes, provided we learn from them. And I learned an awful lot to do with business, an awful lot to do with how to deal with customers. And it was absolutely a marvellous education.
And you mentioned mistakes. What mistake do you think you've learned most from?
I'd say I've learned most, well, about how to treat customers. And at the end of the day, people buy from people. They don't buy from emails. It's as simple as that. They don't buy from texts. They buy from people. And if you have a good rapport with people, and if you're there to provide them with what they want, I think, you know, it makes a huge difference to their life, but it makes a huge difference to your life too. The satisfaction you get from knowing that you have a satisfied customer, it's fantastic.
What's been your favourite part of your journey as you look back now through it all? You know, what's been the favourite part for you?
I think the favourite part was I suppose in the latter years, like now, building up Pamex, it was wonderful, you know. And I was lucky in the sense that in the different jobs I had, like, which was most unusual in the first 4 years that I was in the workforce as such, and I was on the road, I had four different jobs, which was unusual in those days. But I progressed from every single job and I learned something in every single job. And, you know, the pharmaceutical industry, I think, is a wonderful, wonderful industry. And you bring new products to people and you can do so much good for those people. Yeah. It's absolutely amazing. It's fascinating. That's the way I put it. And I'm all the time fascinated by it. So I'd say that whether it be Syntex or whether it be in Pamex, and I learned an awful lot there.
And what percent of your success do you think is down to hard work and what's down to luck?
Very difficult question, that, because, you see, I looking back on it now, I think I can say now that, yeah, I must have worked very hard. But when you're there in the middle of it, you're just working, you're determined, you know, you're resilient, and all those good traits just come out and they help keep you going. And sure, you have ups and downs and things like that, but I think, you know, you have to have that resilience and determination, and you don't consider it hard work. I loved every minute of it, and I love every minute of it, and I'm sure I bore the pants off people if they asked me to talk about it, because I have been very, very lucky.
And was fear of failure ever a driving force for you?
Not really.
No.
No. To hell with it. Do it.
Do it and be done.
Learn from it and move on.
Yeah. There obviously isn't journeys like this. What were the truly hard parts of the journey?
I remember one instance where we needed money. And I went to the bank. And now, I had got a good redundancy package from Syntex. Mm-hmm. They were very, very good to me in that regard and very helpful. And we had set up Pamex, and we were, I don't know what it was, maybe 2 years into our journey in Pamex, so to speak. And as you know, I think it is up to 75% of companies fail in the first 5 years of business. So I was anxious that we had to get to that 5 years, and we had to get to that 7 years. And then if we got to 7 years and if we managed our progress carefully, we should be okay. But we ran into a cash problem, or I should say a lack of cash, and went to the bank, and the bank at that particular time were not having any of it. And they didn't understand what we did. They couldn't understand how companies would give us products, we would sell them, we'd make money on it. They just didn't understand it. It was different to what they were usually dealing with. And I asked them for money and they said no. And I wondered then, you know, I said I wasn't going to let the banks decide how we were going to run our business, because that's basically what they wanted us to change our business so it would suit their agenda. And I said, no bloody way. And that, I think, got the hackles up of me, and I said, I'm going to get that money one way or another. And I did, through contacts, and we had that money lodged. I told the manager in the bank at the time, I said, I'll do it and we'll have the money lodged, and I said, we'll do it within 3 months. He said, you won't be able to, because we had an extra property at that stage that we'd invested in for my redundancy, part invested in, had a big mortgage on it, but they wouldn't give us any money. They said, you can't have a private property and use that as collateral for a business loan. So, fine. So, I said that I'd get the money, and we got the money. And we were then we learned from that to be extremely careful about cash flow, see how important it is. And we minded that money. We paid it back before the due time. And we showed the bank that we were serious and we could do it. And that was it.
Yeah. And you know, how important was that clarity of purpose then, as you look through the whole Pamex journey?
It was extremely important. Yeah. Extremely important, yeah. Because, you know, and as with all businesses, you know, cash is king. It's as simple as that. And cash flow, you can have a very thriving business, but if you run out of cash flow, you're out of business. It's as simple as that.
When I read in the book, it was an interesting one. You talk about, you know, the key to selling to people. You see, it's enthusiasm transferred. Mm. Talk to me about that, because I think it's a fascinating concept.
Well, if you go if somebody calls to your door, or if you go into a shop even, you know, to buy something, and somebody says, whatever the shop is, you know, somebody might say to you, are you all right there? Mm. Right, I generally say back to them, I'm an awkward old bugger at this stage of life, and I say back to them, yeah, I'm fine, thank you very much, and how are you yourself? You know? But if somebody asks if you could help me, I'd be inclined to engage more. And if that person has a smile, and if they come across that they're genuinely interested in helping me supply, or to get, they would supply me with what I'm looking for. You know, that makes the interaction and the communication far better, right? And far more successful for a sale. So, if your enthusiasm, if you have enthusiasm, and if you're enthusiastic about the product and the benefits, what the product is, and the benefits of the product that's going to go to the customer, you will be able to talk about that enthusiastically. But if you're having a bad day, and if the dog has died at home, and you are not interested in customers, you know, like, what do you want? Mm. As often is said in the shop or something like this, nearly, you know, you're annoying me, don't come near me or anything like that. And I think that's a pity. But if you can, and it's so negative, if you can transfer your enthusiasm to the customer, to say, you know, they'll say, okay, this fella knows what he's on about. I can do business with this guy. And I believe that when you meet somebody, every time two people meet, a sale is made or not. It's simple as that, because you know very rapidly whether you can get on with that individual or not. That's human nature.
Yeah. Then I suppose has the role of the salesman changed in the age of the internet, do you think?
I think it has, to a certain extent, but only to a certain extent, because I'm still a firm believer in people buy from people. Mm. When you deal with a human rather than some AI mechanism, right? And of course, AI, when I was growing up, was artificial insemination. And now they've changed the term to artificial intelligence. And I think there may be something in that. Somebody will do a little thesis on that to see the connection someday, right? But I think when you have that interaction with people, I think it makes for a far better atmosphere for concluding a sale and for making a customer happy.
Does it move from being a transaction to a sale in a way, you know?
Well, the one thing, yeah, I think it does, because, you know, when you have, if you buy something from the internet, it's great, but you don't know who the person is. If something goes wrong, how do you do it? Oh, we're not taking back returns anymore, so how do you do it? You can't talk to somebody. You have to put in an email into a little diagram. You'll be lucky if they're into a chat box. You'll be lucky if they come back to you. If they don't come back to you, you know? And I think it's gone a bit too far. I like to make sure that people are at the centre of what we do. If somebody rings the Pamex office, it's not a robot who answers. Mm. It's a human being who answers. Mm. And most cases, it's Rachel who plays a wonderful role for us in Pamex.
Yeah. Move on now to exactly that staffing thing and the idea of, you know, developing a culture. You say in the book that the culture in Syntex was really special. You know, it was a collegiality, there was a professionalism, there was effective decision making.
Yep.
You know, do you think that type of culture can be developed in any company?
I do.
Okay.
I do. But those in the management position need to be aware of it and need to be willing to go down that road. Mm. You know, and I always remember one of the individuals in Pamex, Glenn McKinnon, saying to me one day, I came in with a problem that we had. I was over and back to the UK, and I came in with a problem that we had in the Irish market. Mm-hmm. And Glenn was based in the head office in Maidenhead in England, and I would go there on a regular basis every few weeks. And I came in was having a chat, and Glenn said, how are things going in the UK, in Ireland? And I said, they're going very well. We're happy with what we have at the moment. We're meeting our sales targets and our reps are doing well and we have a good team. I said, but there's one issue. And I said, I'd like your help on this. And he said, okay. And he said to me then, we discussed the issue, and he said, well, what can I do about it? And I said, well, what do you think about it? And he said, I'm not here to think about it, he says. You're there to think about it. And you come to me with what you reckon the options are and the solutions. And then I will let you know what I think is the situation. Because he said, you're closest to it and you're in the market. So he said, don't come to me with problems. Come to me with a selection of proposed solutions, and then we'll go through them and decide which is best. And I thought it was very good thinking.
And then switching to the PAMEX side of it, you made the point that hiring the right person in a small company is crucial.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it is absolutely critical, you know. And because the person must be the right fit for the job. And in order to make sure that you can achieve that, and you don't always achieve that, but if you can achieve it, you need to, first of all, let the applicant know what the expectations are. I think that's critical. And then you have to sift through the people where you think that the best, who's going to be the best fit. And I always remember a situation in Cork where in the PMI, the Pharmaceutical Managers Institute, we had a lecture from somebody who was high up in human resources. And they told us about how critical it is to get the right people for your employment, regardless if you're a big company or not. And it gave the example, if you were a road making contractor and you were going to Volvo, right, and you were buying a big Volvo tarring machine, right, he said they would bring you over to their base, they'd show you all the makes and models of what they had and everything like that, and these machines might be £250,000 or whatever it was at the time, right, because that machine is going to work for that company, for the new company, right? If you employ somebody, after a few years, you'll have paid them £250,000. But you don't, at that time anyway, you really wouldn't go into that detail in choosing the right candidate, right? The guy who was tarring the roads needed to have the machine that was actually appropriate for his job. Just the same as the employer needs the chap or the lady who is appropriate and the right fit for that job. Right? And he said, always as hire slow and fire fast. And if it is a question that somebody is not fitting in, sit down, have a chat with them, see what the position is. And I've had to do that on a number of occasions. And what has happened on each of the occasions when I was there, the person themselves said, you know, I remember one in particular, I'll never forget it, actually. And the lady said to me, she said, thanks for having this chat with me, because I know I'm not happy in this job and I know I'm not the right person for this job. So you have confirmed it.
You have a very good point in the book about the attitude of Gen Z, and I particularly like the FIFO rule. I think people need to tell people what the FIFO rule is. I've told this story to a few people and it gets a great laugh every single time.
Are we allowed to do
it? Oh yeah, we're absolutely allowed to do it.
Well, it was in that talk in Cork where the lawyer who dealt with HR issues at the time, he was a legal expert in that field, and he said, always remember, as he called it, the FIFO rule, right? F-I-F-O. And he said, does everybody here know what that is, you know? And one of the chaps put up his hand and he said, yes, I do, of course. He says, yeah. He said, but I don't agree with it. And the lawyer said, how do you mean you don't agree with it? Well, he said, F-I-F-O really means first in, first out. And that should not be the case. Should be first in, last out or whatever, you know. So he was arguing this point. And the lawyer said, well, no, that's not what I have in mind at all. So he said, fit in or fuck off. And that was it.
And many, many, many businesses could learn a lesson or two on that, you know.
But we have to do it in a much more better and constructive way nowadays. But still, like, leaving the joking aside, it's a very, very serious aspect of business that the employees do fit in, right? And that they are respected by the employment, right, but set up, and that it is a two-way process. Mm. The person has to be good for the job and the job fit the person.
Let's talk about the merits of seeking advice. We had a quick chat about this beforehand, but let's talk about the merits of seeking it. And then who did you seek advice from over the years?
I'm the kind of individual who I've no shame when I want to find out something. I lift the phone and I'll talk to people rather than write an email, right? I'll see if I can talk to them first of all, because I think in Ireland we don't communicate enough with our colleagues and with people when we need advice. And people sometimes are afraid about that. They're anxious about it. Gee, I'm not going to ring up X, Y and Z because they don't know me and they know anything about it. I said, you know, and my attitude to that is it is absolutely amazing how many people in business are so willing to help others. Really are. And I try to encourage that with the people in our company as well. And the people, when I left Syntex Pharmaceuticals, or when they left me, I sought advice from three successful business people in Castlebar in different lines of business altogether. And I went to them individually, excuse me, and I told them, this is a position I was working with Syntex for the last 20 years. Now, not sure what I want to do. Could you give me any advice? And we sat down and had conversation about it. And each of them, to summarise it, said, listen, you should stick with the pharmaceutical industry. You have vast experience in it. You have learned an awful lot in it. And that's what you should do. So that helped me. And after that, I went to numerous people and asked them when we had problems or issues in our business, listen, here we are, here we are. What do you think I should do about this? What do you think about this? Have you any advice you could give me? And I was never ashamed or bashful about asking. And I always encourage people to ask. And it's the same if people ring up our office looking for me and looking for advice, I'll always give the advice. They mightn't like the advice I give, but I will give them my opinion. Always. Yeah. Free of charge and most welcome. And most people will do the same.
Yeah. Do you miss the day-to-day activity of selling? And in terms of, could you go back to be a sales rep, do you think? Would you like to go back to be a sales rep?
I would, but I know I shouldn't. Let's put it that way.
All right.
No, I've passed on the baton now to a very good guy. Cormac Kearney is his name, and he's our CEO. And I have brought the company this far. I'm now in the chairman's role, and he has to bring it to the next level. And we have a next level to go to, and we have our plans. And, you know, we're well set up in that area. But as long as we have good products, what we do is we get a lot of companies who come to us now rather than us going around seeking products. Mm-hmm. They come to us with products and they want to commercialise the products. The products are good in themselves, but they're not able to commercialise them. Right. So we look at them. We go through a very serious assessment. And we, number one, we find out, are the niche products? No. Is there a niche in the market? And is there a market in that niche? Mm-hmm. And very often, there might be niche products, but there's not a market in that niche. And the one thing we do with everybody who approaches us, we tell them straight out, look, we're not the best fit, if that is the case. We tell them the truth rather than say, yeah, you have a good product and maybe we could do this with it and do that and we'd be able to do X, Y, and Z. We don't. Mm-hmm. Because that's taking up their time and wasting their time. If we honestly think that the product isn't for us, that we're not a good fit, we say no. If we think there's possibilities, we tell them there are possibilities and we will always advise them.
Yeah. There's an idea out there that, you know, if you want someone to act like the owner in your business, you need to make them an owner of your business. So, and as you look and you said you've passed the baton on, is that with ownership and everything and tying people into, because they've got to feel a vested interest in that to drive the business forward.
Yeah, but I think people can feel a vested interest in the business without being an owner of the business. Right. And I think that comes down a lot to how you treat the employees. We treat, as I always say, we should treat people with respect. And there are no silly or stupid questions in our company. You can ask whatever questions you want. We just want people to learn and to grow in the company. It's as simple as that, you know. And we treat everybody as an equal with respect. And as some people say to me, yes, as an equal with disrespect. But that just shows that we have a sense of humour as well. And that's very much part of what we are.
Do you obsess about the small things?
No. I just like things to be right. I don't obsess about the small things, no. But I'm... again, comes down to the thing that, you know, people buy from people. Mm. People are not inanimate objects. They are not, you don't refer to them as that. Mm. You know, it's who rather than that. And we treat them, as I say, with respect, because customers are the reason we're in business. Mm. It's as simple as that. If we don't have any customers, we have no business. Mm. We might have product, but we have no business.
Yeah. It's a completely different route here, but you have a big interest in road safety.
I have, actually.
I know. Yeah. You didn't think I was going to ask you that.
I certainly did not.
Tell me about the interest in road safety.
My interest in road safety goes back to my time in St. Gerald's College in Castlebar, the secondary school, De La Salle Secondary School there. And we had a wonderful, wonderful English teacher called Tommy Kearney. And he's still very, very friendly with him, I must say. A lovely guy. And at the time, there was a Road Safety Association in Ireland, and they had all Ireland debates. And from every secondary school in Ireland could enter. And Tommy Kearney, as the English teacher, entered St. Gerald's, and we debated every single year up to Leaving Cert. And I was lucky enough to be captain of the debating team for quite a number of those years. And we had three or four other guys on the team. And the only proviso was that this subject had to be about road safety. And in those days, it's very difficult to get your head around that there were approximately 700 people killed on Irish roads, right, every year. And the roads were much worse, and there were far fewer cars on the roads. But it gave me an interest in road accidents, how they happen, safety issues, how poor Irish drivers are. And they have no sense of rules of the road. You see them driving, they don't drive around roundabouts, they drive through them, you know? And it's amazing because even in the late 60s and the 70s and that, you had ads on the television showing people how to navigate roundabouts. Unfortunately, there are generations of people now who have never been told how... Actually, I know you're supposed to with your driving lessons and everything like that. And the other thing is, they say, we're the most secretive drivers in Ireland. Will we hell tell you that we're going to turn left or turn right? Oh, no, boy, you have to guess. No indicators work on cars once most of those who get their driving license
get their driving license.
Whatever happens, the indicators go there.
Now... We've come to the black book time. We'll have to wait and see. I'm hoping we're going to be okay on this one. Oh, right. This is an interesting one. A very interesting one. What fears do you have for the future?
What fears do I have for the future? I think that to a certain extent, to a great extent, I think we're losing the ability to communicate. I think, particularly with the younger generations, I think they're wonderful people, but I think they depend more on their mobile phone, on texting, on WhatsApp, Instagram, TikTok, the whole works, Twitter, rather than actually speaking to one another.
I think we're
losing it. And it's amazing, I was talking to somebody the other day who said just that, and we weren't actually talking on this subject. He said he had to send an email about something and somebody answered and they interpreted the email incorrectly, so he had to go back again with an email. He said it took about 6 emails, the whole lot took about, he said, 45 minutes to get it sorted. And he said if I could only get that person on the phone, he said, we would have had it sorted in 3 minutes. You know, I think you can achieve much more. Again, I say, you know, people buy from people. You can achieve much more by speaking to people, by understanding them, understanding what they need, what are their needs, what do they want. If they've an issue here, can we help them with it? And you can do that, like I've said that in 30 seconds, you know, write an email about it and it's crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
That's one thing that I think is a pity. It's not so much a fear. I think it's happening already. Mm. And as for other fears, I'm very optimistic, actually, for the world and for our families and for the rest of us. I hope so. I think we're going to have major battles with health coming down the road eventually, you know. And as Groucho Marx said many, many years ago, he said, you know, old age comes at a very, very inconvenient time.
And on that thought, we'll draw to a close. And that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, Tom Murphy, for joining me today. Don't forget to like, share and subscribe or comment if you enjoy what you heard. Many thanks and see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.